by going back to nature. He uses the example of two plants growing side by side in the Amazon forest. They compete for sunlight, water, and safety from parasites and disease. If one gains an advantage over the other, it starts to overshadow its neighbor. And pretty soon the neighbor isn't getting the sunshine or water that is now being consumed by the faster-growing plant. As the plant grows stronger, it dominates. Pretty soon the smaller plant is crowded out, withers, and dies. Now there is even more space for the dominant species to spread its seeds and multiply. Like plants, people compete. And like the plants, the rewards go to the winner, sometimes exponentially. Clear says in his article that situations in which small differences in performance lead to outsized rewards are known as winner-take-all effects. He's right. Nations compete. Organizations compete. And people compete. Those that rise to the top often dominate for quite some time. Look at Apple, Google, the New England Patriots, or the Golden State Warriors, Alabama and Clemson football. Look at the Roman Empire, the British Empire, or the United States since World War II. Look at how Olympic athletes are able to market their success into follow-on careers. Some, like swimmers, sprinters, or downhill skiers, might have bested the silver medalist by just tenths of a second, yet their reward is outsized. The classic type A person who is both ambitious and talented may rise above the rest because they have exponentially greater determination, a kind of inner grit. Extra effort can and does pay off, and often separates the good from the great, and the great from the truly great. The point of the last chapter is that, at some point, we all reach a culmination place. Initial disappointment in stopping there shouldn't be overshadowed by a negative reflection on the tremendous journey experienced getting there. Reach for the stars, but be mindful of the fact that not everyone can be number one. Finally, as you'll find out in chapter 19, arrival at a particular rung on the ladder could come with great sacrifices that you might regret once you arrive. Be careful what you wish for.
Chapter 12. Change Happens.
If you want to make God laugh, tell him about your plans. Woody Allen. We have been living in a fast-moving world for at least a century. Hundreds of years ago, people lived their lives, and little changed from day to day. Today, one of the few predictable things is that change is constant, and we must be prepared to not just accept it, but adapt and run with it. Change can happen on the flip of a coin, and you have to be ready to reconfigure plans. There's an old saying in the military that no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Not recognizing the need to plan for change is a recipe for potential disaster. That's why the military has branch and sequel plans and contingency plans to supplement the base plan. And this is equally appropriate in the corporate world. Here's a couple of instances when I had to go through significant change. When I was in command of the 2nd Battalion, 10th Cavalry at Fort Knox, Kentucky, we participated in the same annual Reforger exercise, discussed in Chapter 4, that I had participated in as a captain and major during two previous tours in Germany. This time, however, we deployed from the United States to Germany with all our staff, plus key command and control vehicles and other support equipment. Since the early days of the Cold War, Reforger had been a comprehensive, all-in exercise with tanks and heavy weapons. This time, however, we went without the tanks and heavy vehicles. One reason for this was that a huge change had occurred in the world. The Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and people started thinking about a peace dividend. Why would we need such a large European-based military if the Soviet Union had just collapsed? Expensive exercises that included shipping all of the unit's equipment over from the United States wasn't viewed as being as necessary or cost-effective as it had been in past years. At the end of the exercise, we found ourselves on the wash racks in Grafenwöhr, Germany, cleaning our vehicles and equipment. It was about 2 a.m. in January of 1990, with the freezing rain making our efforts even more miserable and numbing, when our brigade commander, Colonel Don Smith, called all seven of his battalion commanders together to tell us that the Army would be downsizing, and one of the victims of this reset would be the 194th Separate Armor Brigade. We were shocked. He explained that our seven battalions, consisting of over 5,000 soldiers, would transition into a single combined arms task force of approximately 1,000 men. He then said, "Craig Weldon will be the commander of this newly formed task force." I went through very mixed emotions that night. I had just been knocked off one mountain, but immediately told I was about to climb another. I was tasked with converting a 450-man tank battalion to a 1,000-man combined arms task force of armor, infantry, and artillery. We were told to choose the best equipment to keep and select the highest quality soldiers with the most longevity from the other six battalions to hold on to. My organization would go into a readiness condition 5 status until the task force was formed, meaning that the Army would not levy requirements on us during this period of transition, which should last approximately a year. On my return to Fort Knox, I set upon the task of rearranging the deck chairs on the 194th Titanic. As you can imagine, morale in the other battalions was not high. They were folding their flags and disbanding. My challenge was that, in forming a new team, I had to ensure it would become a cohesive group with a single purpose, not a collection of soldiers who wanted to live in the past and be somewhere else. I also had to spend the coming months inventorying equipment, determining what was best to keep, which soldiers to transfer in and out, and how to train a unit that would be unique to the Army. There was no other unit quite like what became Task Force 1st Battalion 10th Cavalry. We were in the midst of this reorganization when, on August 2, 1990, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. The entire United States military now had to change its focus. From decades of staring down the Soviet Union across the Iron Curtain to deploying to the Middle East to get ready to fight a desert war. Within days, the 82nd Airborne, one of the crack units of the Army, sent airborne troopers over to Saudi Arabia to block any penetration of Iraqi tanks should they push south from Kuwait in order to take control of the Saudi ports so critical to our entry into the area. We may never know whether Saddam Hussein would have done this, absent these brave airborne soldiers. But some of us were thinking they would be little more than speed bumps on Saddam's road south, since they were so lightly armed. General Gordon Sullivan was the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army at that time, and he visited Fort Knox to assess the readiness of the armor force. He too was an armor officer and well understood what was required. When it was my time to brief, I informed him that we were in a readiness condition 5 status of transition and reorganization, but we still had equipment on Fort Knox. I offered that my former tank battalion could either be reassembled and deployed, or we could accelerate the reorganization and be ready to deploy very soon, despite not having trained the new task force as a unit. General Sullivan decided that we should continue the reorganization, but in the short term, I was directed to send my tank commanders to Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, to become trainers for the U.S. tankers coming into the theater from other parts of the world. The Army had brand new 120mm M1 Abrams tanks in storage in Europe, and these pristine conditioned tanks will be brought to the Middle East to support the ground war. Much of the armor force had not yet received this tank and was still using Abrams tanks with the 105mm gun. There was a need to train tankers on the differences between the two tanks, and my tank commanders became those trainers. The rest of my battalion would stay at Fort Knox to train returning individual ready reserve soldiers who were being recalled to active duty for the war. These were soldiers who had recently left the service, but were still subject to recall.
Small ways to acknowledge the past.
I discovered several techniques for dealing with change during this time. First, while you may ask people to move on and forget how things were in the past, it can be useful to allow a small remnant of their former lives to remain. A good way to do this is through acknowledging and recognizing symbols of their past. My challenge was making the men from the seven disparate battalions feel like they were all part of the same newly formed team. There were soldiers from two different tank battalions, one infantry battalion, one field artillery battalion, a maintenance and support battalion, a medical battalion, and an engineer battalion. Once they had been selected, it became clear that many lamented the fact that they were no longer identified with and by their former unit. Some felt that in joining this hybrid organization, they would lose their branch identity. I had to find a way to fix that. One solution was to let the men literally wear the past on their uniforms. While everyone had to wear the crest of the 1st Battalion, 10th Cavalry, on their headgear, hat, I allowed each of the infantry, artillery, and other branches to wear their former crest on their pocket lapels, signifying their association to their basic branch and their disbanded battalions. The Army is usually very particular about uniform standards, and this was at odds with those standards. But I asked for and received permission to do this from my leadership. If you are faced with a reorganization or a significant transition that you have to lead people through, I suggest you find some type of symbol that people have strong feelings about and allow it to remain. It might be a flag, a former company logo, or an old mission statement. Whatever it is, let it help smooth the transition to whatever the change is leading you towards. View it as a bridge from the past to the future. Another thing I did to help ease the transition was to create a formal ritual to help people embrace their new organization, a way to bond the team, to bring them together to recognize the worth and contribution of every individual towards the whole. I used such a ritual whenever we had a major training event for the new task force. We created a recognition ceremony conducted at sunset in torchlight formations, something I had seen in films of the German army during World War II. During these events, I recognized soldiers and small units from every prior battalion. I focused on everyone, going well beyond the traditional tankers, infantrymen, and artillerymen to also recognize cooks, mechanics, and fuel and ammunition handlers, who all played a role in any collective success. It was a challenge to bring these disparate groups together, but when I turned over the unit colors to my replacement in July 1991, I felt like we had finally come together as a team, and every soldier was proud to be a member of Task Force 1st Battalion, 10th Cavalry. Like me, they accepted that change happens, and they did just fine moving forward.
Chapter 13. The Whole Equals the Sum of Its Parts.
For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. Rudyard Kipling. It was during this time at Fort Knox, when we were fighting Desert Shield and Desert Storm, that I faced a leadership challenge anyone could face. How to manage the conflation of strong ambition with equally strong disappointment among the leaders in my task force. The military is full of brave young Americans eager to show they can take on any task, even when it risks their life. The corporate world, too, is filled with ambitious, hard-charging people who want to demonstrate their business prowess, developing new products or opening new markets at great risk to the bottom line. In either case, a leader has to know how to work with these personalities, sometimes encouraging them, sometimes restraining them, but always supporting them. I faced this challenge when I was in command of the task force described in the last chapter. It was an organization of nearly 1,000 men. Most of my 40-plus officers and many of the men under them lamented the fact that they were not deploying for what they believed would be the greatest tank battle since World War II. It was the Super Bowl, and they were sitting on the bench. In their view, other tank battalions in the Army would deploy to the Middle East and would return as heroes, able to wear the revered combat patch on their right sleeve, a sign of virility among soldiers, at a time when there hadn't been a big fight for many years. A combat patch made a statement all its own about, "I've been there, done that," irrespective of how well it may have been done. No one in our battalion that I remember had a combat patch except Command Sergeant Major Jerry Utterback, who earned his in Vietnam. Once my officers knew that they would not deploy to the Middle East, I realized that I had to assure them that they still served a valuable purpose in our army and in support of the overall war effort. I explained that their job would be equally important, perhaps even more so, than some of those who crossed the Iraqi or Kuwaiti border. While I think there may have been some truth to this, I'm not sure my officers believed me at the time. Even I doubted what I was saying because I too was disappointed that we were staying back. But I believe my words had a long-term effect on them, especially when I told them that if anyone in the battalion was to be professionally shortchanged as a result of not deploying to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, it would be me. After all, I was already a lieutenant colonel, and my professional path forward led through an ever-narrowing path of selection boards. The higher you rise in the ranks, the tougher it becomes to reach the next rung on the ladder, as I wrote about earlier. My rungs were becoming further and further apart, and my professional future in the Army was even more uncertain, now that I would be competing with combat-experienced battalion commanders for the next promotion or selection for command. I assured my lieutenants and captains that their careers were not being jeopardized. Their careers wouldn't start becoming really competitive until they competed for resident attendance at Command and General Staff College. For most of them, this was still 5 to 10 years away. By that time, the war experience gained by others would be a faint memory to the board members selecting them. What really counted is how well they did whatever they were asked to do, and wherever and whenever they were asked to do it. Again, I'm not sure even I believed what I was saying, but I do believe my message resonated. And it turns out that I was spot on. The ground war lasted just 4 days, and while the deployment of other units to Saudi Arabia spanned many months, much of that time was spent getting ready, a fairly routine and sometimes boring task. As I told my men, the fact that one is in the combat zone does not per se mean that they had a leg up on those who were not there. Everyone still had the same potential to be promoted. Selection boards understood this at the time. Two lieutenants in the audience that day, John Epperly and John Andony, now serve as Army general officers.
Toxic competition.
In the same unit, I had more localized experience that demonstrated how the whole equals the sum of its parts, but when separated and competing against each other, they can weaken the whole. We were getting ready for a major gunnery training event, and I noticed what might be viewed as unhealthy competition among two of the tank company commanders. Each was determined to be the best company coming out of the gunnery event. From their perspective, they didn't see the value, as I did, of sharing good ideas or helping each other if it might give the other a leg up. I pulled them aside one day to reinforce the point that while I value healthy competition, I value teamwork even more. Ultimately, I would grade them on not just quantifiable gunnery scores, but also on how they worked together, how they shared good ideas, how they made each of the individual parts contribute to the whole, our entire battalion. It is the same principle I experienced in Ranger School years before, where teamwork became one of the most valuable aspects of a student's evaluation. One of Benjamin Franklin's oft-repeated quotes is, "We must, indeed, all hang together, or, most assuredly, we shall all hang separately." Most of us don't experience the level of importance, national survival, that Franklin was referring to when he said this. But truly great leaders understand where the crossover point is between personal and sometimes competing ambitions of individuals versus the contributions of each as a member of a team to the collective good of the whole. There is room for both. Great leaders know where these sometimes competing interests intersect. Finally, I'm reminded of a TED Talk by Margaret Heffernan titled, "Why It's Time to Forget the Pecking Order at Work." Her talk can easily be found on the internet and is an instructive lesson on the value of what bonds the whole together. She uses the metaphor of a brick wall, and when she says,
"It's the mortar, not the bricks,"
she's referring to what holds us together, that gives us strength, as opposed to the individual bricks. I often refer to this TED presentation in my talks while displaying a photo of the Great Wall of China. Without the mortar, that which binds it together, it would just be a huge pile of bricks.
Chapter 14, Memento Mori.
The supreme quality for leadership is unquestionably integrity. President Dwight D. Eisenhower. I was about 18 months into command of the base in Würzburg when I got a call from the 3rd Infantry Division commander, Major General Montgomery, Monty Meigs, my former boss in Schwabach years before, asking me to come up to the division headquarters. He told me that the chief of staff of the army had approved my leaving my command 6 months early to become his chief of staff, replacing a colonel who was being relieved for indiscretions with a subordinate civilian female employee. In the next few hours, I turned over my duties to my executive officer and moved up to the division headquarters. The colonel I replaced had been my next-door neighbor, but he was gone in 10 days, forced into retirement. This kind of episode occurs too often. It's a failure of character and a stain on any profession. It reminds me of a story about how excessive hubris infects some people when they gain power. A Roman general enters Rome after a large victory. Standing behind him on his chariot is his slave, tasked to remind the general that though he was at his peak today, tomorrow he could fall. The servant conveyed this by telling the general, "Memento mori." Literally, "Remember, you are mortal." Ethical behavior should be non-negotiable. It pains me to see senior military officers and business executives in the news for violating this basic foundational principle of leadership. Power corrupts those of lesser character, and it can be a slippery slope if you find yourself getting away with behavior you should know is unacceptable. It feeds on itself and can be like a metastasizing cancer on the soul. I often wonder why and how this happens. It's particularly embarrassing to witness senior military leaders fail in this critical area of leadership in a profession that, year after year, is regarded as one of the most trusted institutions in America. It is all the more important to remember memento mori as you rise in your organization and become a senior leader. Realize that as you climb the corporate ladder, you start to live in a glass house. Everyone is watching, and people will judge not only your words, but also your deeds. The world should never revolve around you. You are a servant leader. Practice humility, always adhere to high standards of integrity, and set the example in all you do. Keep in mind the statement from Albert Einstein: "Whoever is careless with the truth in small matters cannot be trusted in important matters." World-renowned leadership author and speaker John C. Maxwell said, "Your talk talks, and your walk talks, but your walk talks louder than your talk talks." A tongue twister for sure, but once dissected, it's clear what it means. When I was promoted to Brigadier General, I remember asking my boss, Major General John Van Alstyne, what was different about being a general. I felt exactly the way I did the day before, when I was a colonel. He said, "Your jokes don't get any funnier, you don't get any better looking, and if it tastes good, spit it out." Although humorous at first, there's deep meaning in that very sage advice. His point was clearly to not let elevation into the senior ranks go to my head. Temptations coming my way must be rejected. Two key and critical leadership traits were profiled to me that day: humility and integrity. These are just part of the elements of character, the building block of all great leaders, discussed in Chapter 1. For the past 20-plus years, this has been the foundation of what I pass on to others who arrive at that same professional crossroads. Every year, I send a letter to newly selected generals, first in the Army, then in the Marine Corps, passing on this sage advice from John Van Alstyne. What really counts is not the cheering crowd, but rather having a firm understanding of what the citizens actually say and think about you after your chariot passes.
Ethical boundaries.
When I was a general officer, one of the things I did regularly was gather together my immediate and closest staff members, aide, secretary, driver, etc., and tell them that I would never cross an ethical boundary intentionally. Because of my position, though, I would often be put in circumstances that could pull me in that direction, unknowingly, and the last thing I wanted to do was to find myself on the other side wondering how I got there. I picked up this rock from Major General Meigs when I was his chief of staff. Because these were the members of my team that spent most of their time with me, I charged each of them to keep their antenna up for these kinds of situations and say something if they saw us drifting in that direction. I then turned to my lawyer, who was in attendance, to let him tell everyone present exactly where those boundaries were. I've seen a number of general officers use a technique similar to this. Not only does it keep you inside the boundaries, but it sets the bar for your entire organization regarding where you stand on ethical behavior. And it often sets the same bar for them.
Chapter 15. Managing Risk.
Being a Navy SEAL and sniper taught me all about risk management. Take away all the risk variables under your control and reduce it to an acceptable level. The same fundamentals apply in business. Brandon Webb. One of the key elements of leadership is helping your company, your team, or your family navigate risks. It's a volatile and chaotic world, and leaders must know how to face risks and survive. You may need to make decisions for which there are known financial risks, new product or service risks, competitive risks, or even the risk of physical harm to your people or your family. We all also face risks that cannot be calculated in advance, and for which we are thus unable to prepare. I have encountered a few risks in my life and have learned something from each of them that I will explore in this chapter. I believe my experiences with getting through risky situations have contributed to making me a more effective leader.
Risk lesson number one. Life experiences help shape your appreciation of risk.
Humans are born with natural instincts or skills about how to recognize or handle risks. As children, our brains are naturally inclined to believe that the world is safe and that we can conquer most things we encounter. Children often feel they can get away with anything until something happens that teaches them otherwise, or parents intervene. Ironically, while humans are the most advanced species in the animal kingdom, we seem to be the slowest to appreciate the dangers around us. That's why we must be nurtured for such a long time before setting off on our own. I was just 6 years old when I had my first near-death experience. My father was in the Air Force and stationed in England, and my family was on vacation in Switzerland. We were high in the Jungfrau mountain range when I strayed off the beaten path and fell into a 30-foot snow crevice. Bravely, my dad jumped in after me, but only succeeded in trapping us both 30 feet down. Hours later, we were fortunately pulled out by Swiss mountain rescue teams, in good shape, but extremely cold. We later learned that had I continued falling about 2 more feet beyond where I stopped, I would have dropped another 200 to 300 feet, certainly to my death. On that day, I did not understand the life-threatening situation in which I put myself and my father. I remember telling my mom afterwards that I lost a red mitten in the crevice, as if suggesting she should go retrieve it. I tested fate a few more times before turning 20 years old. One of the most serious was just after my freshman year in college. I spent time in southern England working at Camp Mohawk during my high school years and into college. This was a youth camp on the Salisbury Plain near Stonehenge, England, and was a wonderful place where children of the U.S. military from throughout Europe could spend a few weeks each summer. I had been a camper there myself when I was 7 or 8 years old. After my senior year in high school, the camp's director asked me to run the Whitewater Canoe Teenage Adventure Trip when I returned the following summer, following my freshman year at Purdue. This trip would take about 30 teenagers ages 14 to 16 downstream on the Wye River in Wales, spanning a 10-day period. At the time, I was just 17 and had not yet received my driver's license. Not realizing the enormity of the responsibilities I would inherit, and apparently the camp director not recognizing the liabilities he might incur, I readily agreed, as it seemed like another great adventure. Another mountain to climb. I spent the summer of 1969 as an apprentice, called right seating, with the outgoing trip leader to learn the river for the following summer, when I would be in charge. What I didn't know during these trial runs was that the river was unusually low that summer. This training trip was uneventful and great fun. The following spring, however, a few months before I started leading the trips myself, Wales had record rainfall. When I arrived back from my freshman year in college in the summer of 1970, The water on the Wye River was exceptionally high. Safety protocols for our trip required that we pull up just short of each set of rapids, beach the canoes, walk to the edge of the river overlooking the rapids, and talk through our strategy to get through them. Once the group understood how to get through, a safety officer with a rope was placed downstream, and the group would observe me going through first. Once through, I would disembark, then oversee and supervise each of the remaining two-person canoes through the rapids one at a time. At 18 years old and responsible for the lives of 30 teenagers, I thought I knew what I was doing. However, the river looked very different than the year before. Most of the landmarks I had carefully marked on the map and memorized were now underwater and couldn't be seen. When we approached the first set of rapids, I didn't see expected landmarks. Some were submerged. We were quickly pulled into the main current. There was no turning back or pulling over to the side, so I looked over my shoulder and yelled for the seven canoes behind to follow me. We all had life vests, but rapids are dangerous nonetheless. Of the eight canoes, six made it through. Two did not. The four teenagers in those two canoes were upended and thrown into the cold water racing downriver. One of the canoes hit a boulder, spun around, and got locked onto a second boulder. It was caught in a chute that had a depth of about 5 feet. Fortunately, the four canoers managed to find their way to calmer water and extract themselves to the bank. All were safe, but I felt terrible that we had an expensive aluminum canoe locked between two large boulders, facing upriver, with the rushing water holding it fast. This was when I made the fateful decision to recover the canoe, as I couldn't imagine returning to Camp Mohawk one canoe short. I didn't pause to assess my chances, nor did I recall my falling through the crack in the mountains in Switzerland a dozen years before. Instead, I selected the largest and strongest teenager to help me retrieve the canoe. We went upriver to a point where we could float downstream, hopefully landing on the stuck canoe. We removed our life vests so their bulk wouldn't interfere with our manual work to free the canoe. You're now probably wondering, what was he thinking? In retrospect, I wasn't. Once at the canoe, we braced ourselves against the boulders and rocked the canoe back and forth until one end finally gave and the strong current began carrying it downriver. I yelled at the teenager to grab the canoe, as it was buoyant and would keep him above water. He did so. I then lunged for the canoe myself, but missed and found myself at the mercy of the currents, and yes, without a life jacket. The next few minutes are a fog. I recall only being dragged by the gushing water over boulders, completely losing my orientation and not finding air. I was running out of breath, and for an instant, I thought it was the end. I eventually found the surface, gasping to fill my lungs, and was able to find my way to calmer waters. I was exhausted and had no feeling in my legs. Despite little strength and without use of my legs, I managed to drag myself to the side of the river and lay there for what seemed an eternity until the numbness subsided. The kids found me and helped me recover. But we now had only seven of the eight canoes. The eighth was found 2 days later, 10 miles downriver, trapped in a downed tree. Meanwhile, the aluminum body of the canoe we had freed was torn and banged up beyond use. I took it back to Camp Mohawk at the end of this trip, but had a difficult and embarrassing time explaining to the camp director what happened. With this out-of-shoot experience behind me, the following two canoe trips I led that summer were uneventful, but I learned a powerful lesson about risk, one that has stayed with me since. I often talk about it when giving talks to groups about risk analysis and management. The takeaway for leaders is that you cannot assume that your people, especially young people, truly understand and appreciate the nature of risk. People far too often fail to recognize an obvious risk when it is sometimes staring them in the face. Leaders must be constantly vigilant and open the eyes of their team to the many known risks surrounding them, ensuring they understand them. Then, they must develop a plan to mitigate those risks.
Risk, lesson number two. Use the proper equipment and follow safety protocols.
Every time you get into a car, I hope, you put on your seatbelt. That's because you know it makes sense to use the equipment designed to reduce your risk of dying in an accident. Unfortunately, I've witnessed too many tragic accidents in the military when soldiers did not use equipment properly or neglected to follow established safety protocols and procedures. I recall a very tragic incident when I was a tank platoon leader at Fort Hood, Texas, in the mid-70s. Field operations involving tanks are dangerous. The tank itself was a 52-ton behemoth and fraught with risk, whether conducting live-fire exercises or just moving it across a motor pool. In one field exercise, my unit was on some high ground, in a defensive position, waiting to be assaulted by the opposition in a force-on-force exercise. In the early morning hours of the fourth day, a tank from another platoon was moving along the ridge and got too close to the edge. The right track found its way over the precipice, resulting in the tank tipping over and rolling to the bottom, killing a lieutenant inside. Tanks in those days had a seat for the commander that was normally kept in a stored position above the radio, because it was only supposed to be used when conducting long marches on flat roads or highways, where there is less risk. Autobahns are the major highways of Germany. But in this incident, the lieutenant had the Autobahn seat locked in place with the upper half of his body protruding from the tank commander's cupola. He didn't have time to get the seat properly stored as his tank went over the edge. The rest of his crew, though banged up, survived. When I later saw this tank in our motor pool, its top was covered by the remains of this unfortunate young officer. During my 3 years at Fort Hood, there were other incidents of soldiers sleeping on the ground who were run over by tanks in the middle of the night because their area was not adequately marked or guarded. In another tragic incident, a tank in a motor pool had just finished being cleaned with high-pressure hoses and was being moved over to the maintenance bay for some routine maintenance. One of the crew members was on the ground guiding his tank, motioning to the driver which way to turn and when to stop. Violating procedures, he placed himself between the tank and a building, and when he motioned for the tank to stop, the driver pressed the brake, but with wet boots from the tank washing, his foot slipped off the brake, and the tank continued to roll forward, pinning the ground guide against the building and killing him. In all these cases, appropriate risk management was not done. In the first case, the lieutenant was not using the equipment properly, and in the other cases, soldiers were not following established safety protocols. Sadly, all these incidents resulted in deaths that did not have to happen. All the participants were young, still teenagers or in their early 20s. They were also very inexperienced, not having been in the Army more than a couple of years. Tragically, leaders are too often unaware that their team members are not using the tools correctly or following appropriate safety protocols. Though we can't be everywhere for every risk situation, we should realize when risks are rising and then prepare our people, particularly the young and inexperienced ones, by insisting they pay attention to the right way to use their equipment and that they follow safety rules. Sometimes, extra layers of supervision are appropriate.
Risk lesson number 3. Risks show up from nowhere, often when least expected.
While still a ROTC cadet at Purdue, I attended the 3-week airborne school at Fort Benning, Georgia, to learn how to parachute from military aircraft. Some might ask why a future armor officer would need to jump out of airplanes, but the 82nd Airborne Division had, in that day, a tank battalion that dropped tanks from aircraft. In addition, we never knew when a soldier, of any type, might be assigned to the staff of an airborne unit. For me, at 20 years old, it was just another adventure, another mountain to climb. Those who have never done a military jump need to appreciate that the goal is to get jumpers on the ground as fast as possible. As such, the height from which the jump is made is much lower, 1,200 feet in training and 800 feet in combat, than civilian jumps. And the military parachute is designed to move through the air at maximum speed, but within risk tolerance to the jumper. you hit the ground relatively hard. So perfecting the PLF, parachute landing fall, is essential. On one of my jumps, I witnessed a phenomena that stays with me to this day. With several hundred jumpers in the air at any given time, the sky becomes very crowded. Students are told to give wide berth to other jumpers. If you drift over the top of another jumper, you can find yourself in a vacuum with no air to sustain your chute. On my third jump, I saw this occur. Another jumper drifted over the top of another chute, and the air, keeping his chute open, disappeared. His chute collapsed, and he flew past the jumper below him. Once past, the air caught his chute, and it reopened. But now, the other jumper was above him, and his chute lost its air. I don't recall how many times I saw this leapfrog occur, but the two jumpers could not get away from each other, and one of them reached the ground before his chute fully redeployed. He broke both legs and didn't graduate. I don't know if he ever returned to try again. Another incident at jump school taught me something about risk as well. As mentioned earlier, my dad flew C-47s in the early 50s in support of the airborne school. The outside skin of a C-47 is full of rivets, including surrounding the door that jumpers exit. The students are told to put their hands on the outside of the aircraft and pull themselves out to help propel the body beyond the side of the aircraft and into the wind stream. My dad was piloting an aircraft when a jumper caught his wedding ring on a rivet while exiting the door. He left his ring finger on the aircraft as his body dropped to earth. Because of this, my dad never wore a wedding ring, much to the chagrin of my mother. He told me this story before I attended jump school, and while I didn't have any rings then, I found myself checking the hands of my airborne classmates to ensure they didn't either. My nephew, Jason Dixon, had a similar experience. In 2008, he was attending the Warrant Officer Basic course at Quantico Marine Corps Base, Virginia, a physically demanding course. It includes a long obstacle course with an 8-foot wall that students had to go over. On one of these training events, he jumped up to grab the top of the wall, pulled himself up, and dropped to the far side. Regrettably, he was wearing his wedding ring, and his finger stayed at the top of the wall. A nail was protruding just enough to catch his ring. Because Jason was in excellent physical condition, he was kept in the course, even though he did no further obstacle course runs. He graduated 2 months later, minus one finger. Today, as part of the safety orientation for incoming students, a photo of Jason's four-fingered left hand is shown to incoming students with the official story of how it happened. There are a number of unofficial stories how he lost his finger as well. For a while, his youngest son believed it was lost in a bear fight, which Jason obviously won.
Conclusions about risk.
All these experiences have made me far more aware of risks. I long ago learned that it was my job to teach others, especially young people, about risk and ensure that they take the right precautions to minimize it. Risk management is now second nature. The military has a simple 5-step process that can be applied in combat and in training. It can also be applied in business or in your daily life. Anyone can use this simple tool regularly whenever facing risks. It has served me well, and it can do the same for you. Number 1, identify the hazards. Number 2, assess the hazards. Number 3, develop controls and make risk decisions. Number 4, implement controls. Number 5, supervise and evaluate. And then, returning back around to number 1, identify the hazards, and then moving again back around full circle. As the years have passed, I've also reflected on the psychic makeup of teenagers and young adults and the risks they are sometimes willing to take. This is especially important in the military, with such a large demographic between 18 to 22 years old, coupled with the inherent adventurism of young people who join the military. It is also true for many businesses that employ young millennials fresh out of high school or college.
Research has shown that the human brain continues to develop well into early adulthood,
The prefrontal cortex, which starts development around puberty, isn't completely formed until about age 25. This portion of the brain controls impulse inhibition, goal planning, and organization. It also feeds a reward system that results in young adults under 25 often taking unnecessary risks because, in their mind, the rewards are worth the risk. This was the case for me when I was trying to free the canoe in the rapids of the Wye River. Paradoxically, this lack of experience with risk is why young people make good soldiers or Marines, but it's also why we lose too many of them to avoidable accidents. They are willing to put their lives at stake for their country and take far bigger risks than older people would typically take. This is precisely why it is a leader's responsibility to assess the level of risk using tools similar to the one described earlier. Incorporate mitigations as needed, and then supervise the execution to ensure that risk and reward are in the appropriate balance. Don't risk not doing so.
Chapter 16. Stepping Up in Times of Crisis.
When written in Chinese, the word crisis is composed of two characters. One represents danger, and the other represents opportunity. President John F. Kennedy. There are times when you, as a leader, must reach deep into your soul and take charge of what already is or will soon become a serious crisis for your organization. These episodes may be far and few between, but you need to be prepared for them psychologically, intellectually, and operationally. Some leaders never give a thought to what they would need to do or how they might need to react should a true crisis threaten their organization. But if you are not prepared to assess the situation, know your options, and make decisions, you might risk harm to your people, your assets, and even your survivability. People depend on you to lead them through a crisis, and sometimes it means dealing with situations you never imagined you would encounter, and developing new skills that you didn't know you had. I experienced this once, and it is a story worth telling. For many Americans, 9/11 was such a crisis. I happened to be in Washington, D.C. that fateful day at an Army Installations Conference, being held in a hotel just across the highway from the Pentagon. The circumstances of my being there were eerily coincidental, as I was stationed in Hawaii at the time, not in Washington, D.C. At that time, I was the deputy commander of U.S. Army Pacific, and part of my responsibilities included oversight of base operations in the Pacific. The conference was being held at the DoubleTree Hotel, just across from Interstate 395, the main artery into Washington, D.C., coming from the south. This highway is about the only thing that separated the hotel from the Pentagon. The Assistant Chief of Staff for Installation Management, AXIM, was the Army's senior staff officer charged with resourcing and running of Army bases. At that time, the AXIM was Major General Robert Van Antwerp, my former boss from my time running Army morale, welfare, and recreation programs. His offices were in the Pentagon. But on this day, there were dozens of his staff members over at the DoubleTree. That morning, we were assembled in a basement conference room and had just started our meeting when someone came into the room to announce that a plane hit one of the World Trade Center towers. At the time, no one could fully ascertain the circumstances, so we didn't react. Like the rest of the country, everyone believed it was accidental. But not long after, another person rushed in to announce that a second plane had hit the other tower. Now we knew that this was no accident. We asked the hotel to bring a television into our conference room so we could monitor the situation in New York, and someone established contact with the Army Operations Center in the Pentagon. Then at 9:37 a.m., just 34 minutes after the second World Trade Center tower was hit, American Airlines Flight 77 hit the Pentagon. As close as we were, we did not hear the impact because our meeting room was in the basement. Soon, someone ran into the room to tell us that there has been an explosion over at the Pentagon. We all ran outside to see a black plume of smoke rising from the Pentagon. At that time, we didn't know exactly where the plane had hit, but we later learned that Ground Zero was precisely where General Van Antwerp's new offices were located. Two secretaries manning the phones were killed, but dozens from that office survived because they were in the Doubletree Hotel with us. We were all angry and confused. How could anyone mount an attack on this scale with box cutters and airline tickets? Protecting the homeland was underpinned at that time by a nuclear triad: ground, sea, and air-based missiles designed to deter an adversary from launching an attack against our homeland. We had spent billions over the past decades to assure such deterrence. I knew this deterrence well, since just a few years before, I had worked in the National Military Command Center as one of the one-star duty officers responsible to the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States for nuclear response. I wore a key around my neck that, when simultaneously turned with my deputy's key, could start World War III and possibly assure the world's destruction. For years, we had been looking outward to detect any threats, not inward. This was sure to be a different kind of war, one we were less prepared for. My first instinct was to call my wife in Hawaii, because she knew I was meeting with an office based in the Pentagon. It was approaching 10 a.m. on the East Coast, so it was only 4 a.m. in Hawaii. I couldn't get through on my cell, so I ran up to my hotel room and called her on the landline. I woke her up, told her I was okay, and asked that she call both my headquarters and my parents in Indianapolis. Later, I found that I had notified Karen even before the Hawaii governor found out, since our national civil defense notification system was untried and rusty. I then rushed over to the Pentagon to see what I could do to help. I saw a gaping hole, but the windows just either side of it were eerily intact. Oddly, windows further away from the impact zone were gone, and both fire and smoke were coming out of these more distant windows. I later learned this was because a section of the building recently renovated and strengthened to protect against terrorist attack was exactly where the airplane had hit. The windows further away had not yet been changed, so the concussion had blown them out, while the closer windows to the point of impact remained intact. Standing in front of the impact zone that first morning, it wasn't clear to me who was in charge. First responders from multiple agencies and jurisdictions had arrived at the scene. The immediate task was putting out the fire and rescuing survivors. So I approached the Arlington County Fire Chief and asked him what help he needed. He told me he could use some blocking and bracing material to shore up the sides of the building, so that once the fire was under control, they could enter and look for survivors and victims. I contacted the nearby 3rd Infantry Regiment, the Old Guard, best known for their highly choreographed rifle drill and ceremonies guarding the tomb of the unknown soldier, and providing dignified services at military burials in Arlington National Cemetery, and asked them to provide needed assistance. Most people don't realize that this elite unit also has a wartime mission and is highly trained in combat operations. An engineer company is part of the 3rd Infantry Regiment and was ideally suited to provide the assistance requested by the fire chief. About 2 hours after my phone call to my wife, I was standing next to an FBI agent when Army trucks started to roll across the field in front of the impact zone. When he saw this, and because I was a uniformed Army general officer, he turned to me to ask who they were and why are they driving across my crime scene. I explained that these were engineers bringing materials to be used by the fire chief to brace portions of the building to render it safer for rescue or recovery of victims inside. I could sense his focus was investigative, while the fire chief's was incident response. Two very different reactions to the same event. So I encouraged him to recognize that the fire chief's view was the higher priority. Sometime that morning, someone yelled on a bullhorn for everyone to move away from the Pentagon, as there were reports of another plane headed our way. We all moved back until the all-clear was given. We later learned that this alert was prompted by United Airlines Flight 93, which was ultimately taken down by passengers in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Later that day, I was standing next to another FBI agent and asked him if he was aware of any centralized command center that had been established. He told me the Arlington County Sheriff's Command van had been set up near the Navy Annex within a mile of where we were standing. He said he was about to go up there and asked if I would like to accompany him. I did, and when I got into his black SUV, I noticed multiple antennae on the top. When I asked what he did, he said he worked in counterterrorism. He also told me there was a fourth plane believed to be headed to Camp David, but that it had been shot down. I later learned that Flight 93 had prompted the bullhorn warning a while earlier. This exchange reinforced for me that early reports in a crisis are often wrong, something I had learned in my military career over and over. Nevertheless, my first thought was to wonder in the days that followed whether there was developing a governmental cover-up about how Flight 93 was taken down. Ultimately, I became convinced that it was Todd Beamer and other brave Americans who took the plane down and probably saved hundreds of people, as that plane was clearly headed for Washington, D.C. Interrogations with terrorists later captured, we had knowledge of the 9/11 planning, indicated that the two targets in Washington, D.C. were the White House and the Capitol, not the Pentagon. American Airlines Flight 77, the one that hit the Pentagon, was probably targeting the White House, and United Airlines Flight 93 was headed to the Capitol when it crashed in Pennsylvania. Here's why. Flying into Reagan National Airport, the Capitol can clearly be seen from the air at a distance, at the opposite end of the mall from the Washington Monument. The White House is much smaller, harder to see, and is nestled in an area surrounded by buildings and trees. Radar tracking of Flight 77 showed that as it neared Washington, D.C., it turned hard right and into almost a full 330-degree circle as it approached, losing altitude along the way. The terrorists in the cockpit, with rudimentary knowledge of how to fly a large airplane at over 500 miles per hour, and unfamiliar with the landscape below, probably couldn't find the White House until it was too late to change the course of a much larger and faster plane than the Piper Cub they had trained on in Florida. Once they realized they were not on a path to the White House, they tried to reposition the aircraft, but it was too late. Losing altitude, the Pentagon became the new target. I'm sure they didn't know that the Pentagon was in the midst of a very expensive multi-year renovation, and one of the only sections that had been completed by 9/11 was the side they ultimately hit. This was a reinforced concrete structure with thickened mylar-covered windows that previously had been 1940s brick and mortar and simple glass panes. Had the airplane hit a side that was not recently renovated, it likely would have penetrated deeper into the center of the building and killed many more people. Many offices were vacant because staffs had been temporarily transferred to local Arlington and Alexandria spaces pending the renovation's completion. This is one of the reasons why the death toll was relatively low, given the magnitude of the attack and the population density of the target area. There were just 189 deaths from this horrendous attack, 125 in the Pentagon and 64 in the aircraft. To provide context, the Pentagon had approximately 18,000 workers present that day, and before the renovation was started, the population numbered over 22,000. If the Pentagon was actually the primary target and the terrorists had done their homework, the bullseye would likely have been the river entrance side, where most of the senior leadership of our military had offices in the outer ring. The chief of staff of the Army was not in Washington, D.C. on 9/11. General Shinseki was in Singapore attending the Pacific Area Military Symposium, a plane named the Grey Ghost, and normally operated by the U.S. Marine Corps out of Hawaii, was dispatched to return him to Washington, D.C. It arrived in D.C. on the 13th of September, and that evening I boarded the Grey Ghost to accompany it back to Hawaii. That was on a Thursday, and only military aircraft and a few charter planes were in the air, as the FAA's grounding of most commercial aircraft was not lifted until Friday, the 14th of September. Ironically, 10 years later, I was to find myself sitting in the same seat on the Grey Ghost during trips to Japan, Guam, and Australia, accompanying the commanding general of U.S. Marine Corps Forces Pacific as the senior civilian in the Marine Corps west of the Mississippi River. I landed back in Hawaii on Friday, the 14th of September, and found that Admiral Dennis Blair, commander of U.S. Pacific Command, had given orders to the U.S. Army Pacific to lead and coordinate the effort to protect the state of Hawaii. My boss was Lieutenant General Ed Smith, and he passed to me the responsibility of overseeing this effort. Recall that in 2001, there was no Department of Homeland Security. In fact, there was not much at all connecting all the various agencies charged with protecting the homeland. It was through these information and intelligence gaps that the terrorist-piloted airplanes flew.